to her. "Sit down with him, Balthazar," Dreyfus told the doctor. "You were with him until he was 16, according to your account. Whatever happened to bury his memories of your involvement, there will be some latent recall. Tell him what you remember about the shell house, and what you discovered. Hopefully that'll jog some memories. And Julius?" His hand free, Garlin stroked his swollen lip. "What the hell do you want with me, Dreyfus?"
"Forgiveness?"
"Not yet," Dreyfus said bluntly. "But you can start by listening." There was a knock at the partition door. Irritated by yet another interruption, Aumonier opened her mouth to demand an explanation. But the person who had arrived was Senior Prefect Mildred Dosso, not someone to test her patience without good reason.
"Supreme Prefect, we need you back in the tactical room."
"What is it, Mildred?" Aumonier asked. Dosso looked around, clearly uncertain how frank she should be in such unusual company.
"The cruiser, ma'am? The Democratic Circus?
What about it?"
"It's heading back to Lethe, ma'am."
Dreyfus, Aumonier, and Detective Marshal Delmar arrived at the heavy bronze doors to the tactical room. Dr. Starsov had been left with Garlin, free to speak to him under the close supervision of Robert Tang and Mildred Dosso. Aumonier hesitated before opening the doors.
"I shouldn't allow you into this room, Detective Marshal. Better people than me have lost their positions over lesser security lapses."
"But I think we might make an exception here," Dreyfus said.
"Yes,"
Aumonier said, nodding slowly.
"I think we might. I owe you some kind of apology, Hestia. May I call you, Hestia? Formalities seem a little superfluous. I gave you the runaround when I should have heeded your requests."
Detective Marshal Delmar appraised this answer and seemed to give some considerable thought to her response.
"A little more clarity and open-mindedness wouldn't have hurt, from both of us.
You have my word that I'll respect the confidential nature of anything I see or hear beyond these doors.
Now, shall we see what the difficulty is with your ship?"
Pressing open the double doors, Aumonier said,
"Pell is a trusted operative. Bankar's on that ship as well. He's reliable." "I've heard that you can be sparing with your praise,"
Delmar said, bending her mouth into half a smile,
"from which I take it that you have a very high opinion of the professionalism of that crew."
"They were given a clear order to retreat. There's no reason for them to have disregarded it," Dreyfus said, following the two women into the darkened hush of the tactical room.
"A situation might have developed,"
Delmar speculated.
"Then they'd have notified Panoply after taking action."
Aumonier moved to the table and invited Delmar to take one of the seats facing her.
"I'm afraid the coffee's cold, but you're welcome to whatever you can stomach."
She turned her head to Clearmountain.
"Did you get any warning, Gaston?"
"Nothing," Clearmountain said, hardly raising an eyebrow at the presence of the Chasm City operative. "Pell's not answering, but our tracer diagnostics show no fault in the comms chain between here and the cruiser." "Where are they now?" Dreyfus asked.
"Over here, sir," said Talia Eng, next to the solid orrery.
Dreyfus moved over to Talia, overjoyed and conflicted in equal measure. At last he had the proof that she was well, or at least capable of being of service. But the doubts he had nurtured since the shell house now crystallized into cold, piercing certainty.
"Are you all right, sir?"
"It's good to see you up and about," he said, trying to smile away his awkwardness. "I was prepared for something worse."
"I'll mend, sir. It's Sparva I'm concerned about. He's on that ship."
Dreyfus forced his mind to the immediate practicalities. "So I gather. Are they back inside the anti-collision volume?"
"Well into it, sir. Current fix has them less than 20 kilometers from Lethe's center of mass."
"Pell wouldn't contravene an order," Dreyfus said, musing aloud, and following a train of thought that could only lead somewhere unpleasant. "So he must still think he's following orders."
"Pardon, sir?"
"Could we get another ship into that area?" Talia conjured some configurations through the solid orrery.
"Not quickly, sir. 30 minutes if we retask one of these assets. Longer..."
He shook his head. "No. It would need to be a ship starting from here, with pre-assigned orders and instructions to disregard any transmissions that come in after they've departed. Talia looked at him oddly.
Are you saying we can't trust our communications, sir?
Dreyfus's face tightened. Something like that.
Then we're stuck.
All operable craft are now in field, other than the cutter you came back with, and that's being refueled, ready for turnaround. Hold it for me. It still won't get you to Lethe in time to do anything about the Democratic Circus, sir. We're not exactly spoiled for choice here, Talia. I'll take that ship as soon as it's ready to move out. Lillian Bowdry had joined them next to the solid orrery, standing with her arms folded and one hand propping up her chin. She watched the enlargement of Lethe, with its splinter-sized representation of the cruiser.
This will turn out to have a simple explanation, Tom. All our services are under strain at the moment. One shouldn't read too much into a temporary drop in communications.
That's a deep-system cruiser, Lillian. It has the capability to take apart an entire habitat, or turn Lethe into rubble. I can't say I'm entirely comfortable with the idea of it going rogue.
And I'm equally uncomfortable with throwing another ship into your side investigation. I hear you've had a sudden change of heart concerning Carlin.
He's the puppet, not the puppet master. I think his brother's in Lethe.
His brother? Did you just say?
Amonie raised her voice.
Lillian, might I have a quick word?
With all of you, in fact. She stood up, her expression reflected back from the shiny surface of the table, ghosted through with the endless scroll of status summaries. She waited a beat, allowing the room to focus its collective attention on her.
Whether or not there's a brother is something we'll get to the bottom of, but I have a witness who strikes me as credible, and Detective Marshal Delmar will, I think, agree with me in that assessment. Am I right, Hestia?
Delmar seemed reticent. She cleared her throat before speaking, rising only at Omonier's invitation.
There may be a brother called Caleb, raised under identical circumstances to Julius, but something drove them apart, most likely the death of their mother, Alia Voy. It's my belief that Caleb's been alive all these years, more than likely using his Voy privileges to slip from one assumed identity to another. This clinic you've all been interested in, Elysium Heights, Caleb could well have been behind it. He'd have been in exactly the right position to siphon away the family funds and lay the ground for wildfire.
After all these years?
Bowdry asked, making no effort to conceal her disbelief.
Yes,
Delmar affirmed.
Caleb's patient. He waited for the right time to unleash this emergency, when the public confidence in your organization was at its lowest ebb, when the Supreme Prefect was already restricted in the range of responses open to her. None of that was accidental.
Sirs,
Talia said, raising her voice from the solid orrery,
I think you should all see this.
Chapter 19. The forensic packages popped away from the belly dispenser in the Democratic Circus, each one a monkey-sized, spider-shaped probe with autonomous guidance and decision-making capability. They selected a variety of landing sites on Lethe and guided themselves down, springing out capture barbs and tongue-like sticky coils at the last moment. Once locked on to the rock, the packages drilled through the plastic integument and began to use precise seismic mapping tools to assemble an increasingly detailed picture of Lethe's interior. Sparva was on the flight deck, watching as vague impressions of subsurface structure hardened into crisp pink detail. Most of his focus was on the volume around the thermal excess, Sparva barely remembering to breathe as the images grew sharper and more provocative.
That's an awful lot of space to give over to basic housekeeping,
Pell commented. Seems like someone's hunch was on the money, Prefect.
Not mine, Sparva said.
And believe me, I'd take the credit if I could.
Gronnik was expert in the interpretation of the forensic package data. Sketching a gloved finger across the images, she lingered over a cyst-like void, tucked under the same pole where there was a thermal excess.
This is a low-density volume, about 3 kilometers across. Maybe vacuum, maybe pressurized, but it's definitely not rock, ice, or stabilizing plastic. It could be a habitable space,
Prefect Bancal.
Do the power requirements add up?
Pell asked.
Depends what they're doing in there, Kralnik said, but it's feasible. In fact, I'd say there's more than enough capacity to manage an ecosystem about that large.
There's nothing like this on the official schematics, Diaz said, overlaying everything that Panoply thought it knew about Lethe. But deviating from official schematics is a civil matter, not a violation of the common articles.
It was true, Sparva reflected. If Panoply bothered itself with every change in a habitat or rock that wasn't properly registered and notified, they would have no time for anything else. But this isn't any old rock, he said. It's Lethe, and we already had grounds to be suspicious of it. Well, Dreyfus did, at least. Can you squeeze anything more out of those packages?
No, Gromnik said. We are at the resolution limit now. It's like knocking on a door to a sealed room and trying to work out where the furniture is, based on the echo.
She tapped at a faint spinal trace.
There's a suggestion of a connecting spur here, running back up to Lethe's center of gravity. That would probably be how you got in and out, if you didn't want to land upside down under a negative G of downforce.
Mr. Diaz, Pal said, signal Panoply that we're sending back the forensic imagery as requested. We'll make one close approach to that pole, run a deep terrain scan, then reverse back out again. Mr. Gromnik, hold at our current threat posture and be ready to interdict any anti-collision measures. Lady Jane had been in no hurry to explain the reasons for sending the cruiser back in again, but Sparva took it as read that there had been a shift in intelligence at Panoply's end, necessitating a closer look at Lethe. He had explained the new orders to the prefects, and they had accepted the revised plan without question, taking it as read that no such order would have been issued without good reason. More than likely, they would complete their deep scan, find there was nothing worth investigating, and be pulled back into the rescue operation, however well or badly that was going. Sparva returned to the flight deck, some small, distant voice in his head insisting that something, somewhere, was not entirely as it should have been. But Sparva reasoned that since very little had seemed right for several days, this disquiet was merely the new normal, and he had better start getting used to it.
"I'm a little clearer about that access duct, sir," Gromnik said. "It has to be an elevator shaft, something like that, so that you can dock as close to the center of grav as possible."
"And that chamber?" Sparva asked. "What sort of gravity would they be feeling in there?"
"Close enough to a G as to make no difference, sir. Can't be accidental. The whole geometry and spin of this rock is just right to provide a habitable volume under that pole."
Democratic Circus was holding station now, allowing Lethe to rotate under it. It took only 3 minutes for the rock to complete its spin, and after a few such cycles, Pal said that the deep terrain sensors had gathered as much information as was possible, given the layers of intervening rock. The interior chamber was roughly hemispherical, with a domed ceiling about a kilometer high, and a gently curving base about 3 kilometers in diameter. Surrounding this volume were layers of insulation and life support management. The connecting thread came in at an offset angle, joining the chamber at its rim, rather than piercing the dome. At its other end, 7 kilometers away, was a right-angled connection to a surface lock and docking emplacement.
"We can just about resolve some interior features," Pell said, "enough to say that the chamber looks mostly empty, except for a structure near the middle of the floor. Could be almost anything. A ship, a building, a machine. It's warm in there, though, and our best guess is that there's some kind of atmosphere. Do you think they'd like us to dock and take a closer look?"
Sparva opened a channel to Panoply and the Supreme Prefect.
"Bankal here, ma'am. We think we've identified a way into Lethe, if you'd like us to conduct a meet and greet."
Her reply came back almost immediately.
"Yes, we see your imagery, Bankal. Proceed with caution, but dock and investigate. Just a reminder that we don't have tactical armament, ma'am. Just armor and whip hounds. I'm sure you'll use whatever is available to the best of your abilities, Bankal. If you run into difficulty, I shall be prompt in tasking assistance."
Sparva nodded to himself as he closed the connection, his qualms in no way dispelled by this latest communication with Jane O'Money. He wished he knew her better, at least as well as he knew Dreyfus.
then he would have known if that paradoxical sense of interested detachment was in some way typical.
Well, he said under his breath, orders are orders.
It was time to go back to the prefects and swallow his pride. Dreyfus, Tullia, Aumonier, and the others watched from the tactical room as the cruiser dropped its forensic packages, then swung in close for what could only be a deep terrain scan. Several more minutes passed, the cruiser maintaining communications silence, neither issuing transmissions nor responding to requests for a clarification of its actions. Then it swung away from its holding position, making a slow but unmistakable vector for one of the surface docks.
I could use that cutter, Dreyfus said.
This isn't the work of someone misconstruing an order or responding to changed conditions, Aumonier said. Pell's acting as if he's following a script, one order after another.
Then a dark intuition clouded her features.
Is it possible, Tom? Given what we know about Garlin and his brother, or don't know, could either of them be using their void privileges to intercept our own signals and feed Pell false orders?
Dreyfus phrased his answer carefully, thinking how easily Aurora had already tricked and manipulated him, firstly by mimicking Aumonier, and then by feeding him lies. Pell can only be following false orders. I have to get out there and instruct him to stand down.
It might be a little late for that,
Lillian Beaudry said, casting a despairing glance at the solid orrery. The new wave of cases isn't easing off. If anything, I believe we might be seeing a further steepening. We've had 6 threshold triggers in the last 4 minutes.
Look on the bright side, Clear Mountain said. At this rate, the entire emergency will be over in less than a month.
Because they'll all be dead, Aumonier answered. That's not my idea of a consolation, Gaston. She coughed, straightened her spine, forced some final spark of authority and confidence back into her voice, as she once again addressed the room.
We've still got a job to do here. I want a revised update on those clinical throughput estimates. It's no good taking people into our custody if we can't get their implants out for days to come. If you see a corner, cut it. We're not striving for perfection.
I'll see what we can do with the surgical throughput,
Clear Mountain said.
Democratic Circus is on final docking approach, Tullia said. No weapons interdiction so far.
We take our blessings where we can find them,
Beaudry said. Dreyfus turned to Aumonier. If the deaths are still spiking, that at least shows we were right to be interested in Lethe. Caleb's in there, I'm sure. He's aware of our presence and he's sending a message.
Not a very bright one, if he wants to avoid being found out,
Aumonier said.
He knows we know, Dreyfus said. Now he wants to make it very plain that we can't use force against him, not while he has direct control of Wildfire.
Ng had a theory, Tom,
Aumonier told him, nodding to Tullia.
It was about Julius, to begin with, but if she's right, it could just as easily apply to Caleb.
Tullia seemed reticent.
It's just a theory, ma'am.
Dreyfus gave her an encouraging look. Tullia swallowed.
I wondered if whoever was behind this wasn't causing Wildfire, but in some way actively suppressing it, with some sort of safeguarding signal. I know it's difficult to imagine anyone doing that, but if half of what we know about Julius or Caleb is true, you see what it would mean, don't you?
Our isolation measures won't make any difference,
Dreyfus said, the full and terrible implications of her idea opening up in his mind, like some vast mansion.
Not just that, but we could easily be making things worse, and we can't neutralize Caleb, even if we were sure he was the only one alive in Lethe.
That's my fear, sir.
Hestia Delmar had risen from the table to join the gathering by the solid orrery.
This is the endgame Caleb's always known would come. That's why he's so unconcerned about you discovering his location. He knows you can't touch him, can't even risk closing off his communications.
You almost make it seem as if he's guided us to this confrontation, Aumonier said, with morbid amusement in her voice.
I think he has all along. Dreyfus told me about the sequence of events in Addison Lovelace, when the partition was flooded. I thought there was something odd about that whole drama even then, and I'm even more certain of it now.
You were being steered to the truth about the clinic, prodded into making the apparent connection to Devon Garlin. That was Caleb trying to goad you into a reckless overreaction. But you did the one thing he wasn't counting on. You showed restraint, good judgment, wisdom.
Omanier almost blushed at this unexpected praise.
Unfortunately, my supply of good judgment is running a little low.
I don't blame you.
But the facts still apply. If Eng's correct, and he stopped sending the suppression signal, all the citizens on your list could be dead within the day.
Then tell me how to get that cruiser to retreat.
Something chimed. Talia lifted up her bracelet, spoke quietly to someone on the other end.
Tyson, sir, by the time you get to the dock, they'll have that cutter ready for immediate departure. With an expedited burn, you can be at Lethe in just under 30 minutes.
There's still not much chance of you reaching Pell in time to make any difference, Omanier said. But if you think it worthwhile...
I'd like to make an additional request, Dreyfus said. No one's going to like it very much.
The prefects were visors down and ready for immediate vacuum operations. As the cruiser completed its final approach, Sparva clambered up and down the aisle, offering such encouragement as he felt able to give.
We've mapped a route in, a shaft that will take us from the dock to what looks like a habitable volume. If there isn't an elevator, it'll be a clean drop. You'll have a tactical overlay compiled from the deep terrain scans.
Will you be accompanying us, sir? Asked Koba.
I'll be right behind you. I came without tactical armor, and the ship can't fabricate me a set at short order. But it can give me an M suit.
You won't be very well protected, sir, said Gurney.
No, but if we do run into trouble, I'll have you to hide behind, won't I?
Sparva had meant it as a joke, but the nervous silence that followed made him wonder if they took him at his word.
Now, let's go over those whip-hound settings one more time.
The ship jerked without warning. Sparva, weightless until that moment, slammed against the nearest wall. The surface softened itself just in time to make the impact painful, rather than bone-breaking. The prefect's couches had swelled up to provide cushioning cocoons. The ship jerked again, and a series of clangs rained along the hull. An instant later, Sparva felt a low, tooth-grinding vibration, which he knew to be the cruiser's rapid deployment Gatling guns, giving back some part of whatever had just been dished out to the Democratic Circus. The return salvo lasted 3 seconds at the most. Then the ship was silent and still again. Sparva said,
Captain Pell, anything I should know?
Pell's voice sounded from the flight deck. The closest ring of anti-collision guns took a disliking to us getting so close, Prefect Bancal. But we took them out before they managed to do much damage. Gronlich says we're out of the sight lines of any remaining hazards. Do you want to back off and deliver an asymmetric response?
Tempted, Captain, sorely tempted, but Lady Jane gave us a job to do.
Force us in if you have to, but complete the docking.
Stand by, Pell said. It was a jolting touchdown, by the standards he was used to, but Pell was taking no chances, and if Sparva had asked him to ram their way into Lethe, he felt sure the captain would have obliged. With the attack neutralized, the prefects were released from their impact cocoons and able to continue checking their whip-hounds and armor. Sparva went forward.
Docked and secure, Pell said. Standard airlock interface, green on all capture seals. You can stroll right in. We'll hold at immediate departure readiness.
Appreciate the show of solidarity, Captain, but I'd sooner you undocked and pulled out to a safe monitoring distance. Use your discretion regarding those remaining anti-collision defenses. If you feel like neutralizing them ahead of time, you won't hear any complaints from me.
I didn't see you bringing tactical armor aboard, Pell remarked.
Sparva touched his forehead absent-mindedly.
Knew I was forgetting something. But you can stretch to an M suit, can't you?
You know where the suit wall is. Go easy in there, all right? None of this is sitting right with me. Not since we got those revised orders.
We're all a little on edge, Sparva said. Comes with the times.
While Pell double-checked the docking arrangements, Sparva stepped through the quick matter membrane of the suit wall and allowed an M-suit to mould itself around him, forming to his contours and fashioning life support, communications and navigation systems within itself
like quick-growing organs. Parts grew transparent, parts grew opaque. Parts hardened or formed flexible joints and detachable seams. A spray of status symbols fed across his faceplate. Sparva fixed two whip hounds onto the adhesive attachment points on the outside of the suit. He would have felt happier with something he could point and aim, but, like the M-suit itself, the whip hounds would have to suffice. He met the four prefects in the staging area, on this side of the lock, the M-suit anatomically establishing a common communications protocol with the other suits. "Reading vacuum on the other side, sir," said Perrek, her stenciled name glowing gently against the dull black of her inert matter armor. "I'm set," Sparva said. "Proceed at your discretion, and be ready for surprises." Cobra had already opened the cruiser's airlock, clamped tight against Lethe's counterpart, with only a quick matter membrane holding back the cruiser's air. Sparva had been through several thousand similar locks, and nothing here looked out of place or in any way remarkable. It was an old, sturdy and reliable design, exactly the sort of thing one would expect on a piece of mothballed real estate which might yet still have some capital value. Cobra reached through the membrane and worked the other lock's manual controls. After a second's hesitation, it opened, grinding back into a recessed slot. All was dark beyond it. Then sets of red strip lights flickered on, revealing a cylindrical chamber, more than large enough for the five of them, with a secondary door at the other end of it. "Whiphound," Perrek said. Singh unclipped her whiphound, keeping the tail retracted, and stretched her forearm through the membrane until she was able to give the whiphound a gentle lob into the space beyond. It sailed on like a rod-shaped miniature spacecraft, red eye blinking as it went into active scan and threat detection mode, a summary of its results appearing on Sparva's visor. The whiphound bounced off the rear door, then came slowly to rest.
"Clear,"
Singh said.
"Proceed,"
Perrek answered. When Dreyfus entered the interrogation room, Devon Garlin and Balthazar Stasov were still facing each other across the lone table, Garlin shaking his head in response to some unheard query from the doctor. Stasov turned to meet Dreyfus, mirroring the other man's gesture.
"It's no good. He just won't admit remembering me."
Stasov's eyes wandered back to the trawl, wheeled back into a corner of the room but still maintaining a threatening presence.
"Do you propose to put him back under that thing?"
"Do you think it would teach us very much, beyond his tolerance for pain?"
"I rather doubt it."
Dreyfus moved around to Garlin and released his restraints.
"That's why I'm trying a different approach."
"What now?"
Garlin asked, "going back to the tried-and-true methods, a locked room and some time alone with me?
I'll spare you the trouble. You could break every bone in my body, and I wouldn't be able to give you the answers you want. About your stupid clinic, these deaths, this man."
Dreyfus grabbed Garlin by the collar, and with a grunt of effort hauled him to his feet.
"I agree. You aren't responsible. But Caleb is, and I need you to get me close to him. This brother of mine who doesn't actually exist. We'll find out soon enough."
Dreyfus shoved Garlin in the direction of the door, Garlin stumbling on unsteady legs before gaining his balance. He braced a hand against the mirrored partition, turned back with his head lowered and his eyes half shrouded.
"Where are we going?"
"Lethe. There's a party of prefects already there. But I figure Caleb's much more likely to negotiate with us if we bring along a human shield. Especially if it's his brother."
Garlin touched his swollen lip.
"This isn't going to end well for you, Dreyfus."
"I'd like to join you," Dr. Stasov ventured, piping up in his high, quavering voice. "You'll accept that I have a somewhat personal stake in the matter. His family ruined me and built a lie on my reputation. I'd very much like to see my story vindicated."
"If it's true, you will," Dreyfus said.
"But I only have room for one passenger in the cutter. Besides, I'd be taking a civilian witness into a questionable situation."
"And I don't count?" Garlin asked.
"You're a grey area," Dreyfus said.
The four prefects went through into the chamber. Singh recovered her whiphound. Cobra examined the controls on the chamber's far end.
Vacuum beyond here as well, sir, he told Sparva, but I think it's safe for you to follow us through. Sparva pushed through the membrane, much as he had done when going through the suit wall in the first place, except that its grab on him was slighter, and the membrane was intelligent enough to know to leave his suit in place. His push carried him through on a slow, bending arc, until he landed and assumed a standing position next to the others. Perek turned the sharp beak of her visor to him.
Ready, sir? Go through,
Sparva said. Kober operated the door. Sparva steeled himself for an inrush of air, but the vacuum reading had been accurate. Beyond the airlock, stretching away to infinity, was an extension of the same red-lit chamber. Sections of it were lighting up in sequence, receding further and further into the distance. It looked impossibly long, but Sparva knew Lethe was only 7 kilometers across at this point, and he doubted the shaft extended much more than half that distance. "Forward scout mode," Perek said, flicking out the tail on her own primary whiphound. "Ascertain the length of this shaft, then hold station at the far end. Gurney, instruct your number one to define a 100-meter moving secure zone." Picking up on Perek's command through the suit channel, the whiphound lunged forward, flicking itself faster and faster with rhythmic pulses of its tail, finding traction even in the near weightless conditions. Gurney's unit sped away just as quickly initially, but only as far as 100 meters, before swiveling around and locking its eye onto them. The prefects advanced, moving along the tunnel in loping, dreamlike strides. Perek and Koba led the squad, Singh and Gurney following behind, Sparva bringing up the rear. Perek's whiphound was still racing ahead, already 0.5 kilometer down the shaft, finding only the same clean-walled corridor with its converging lines of red strip lights. A minute passed, then another. 3 minutes, then 5. Trained to communicate only when necessary, the squad moved in silence. He had to admire their discipline, but Sparva would have appreciated a little mindless small talk to settle his jangling nerves. Perek's whiphound slowed as it neared the limit of the shaft. It came to a halt, scanning rapidly, feeding pictures through to their visors. The shaft had widened out into a small holding area, next to an internal airlock or bulkhead door. "That's got to be the top of the connecting shaft that leads down to the habitable volume," Sparva said. Perek's whiphound held its ground at the head of the shaft, maintaining watch for any hitherto undetected threats. Gurney's whiphound caught up with it 10 minutes later, and the prefects were only just behind it. Kobo wasted no time in determining that the door was the upper access point to an elevator shaft. Some of the power indications were active, but Kobo could neither call nor confirm the position of the elevator. He spent a couple of minutes trying to coax a response from the control panel, then turned to Perek with a shake of his helmet. "Get the door open one way or another," she said. "We can drop down the shaft if necessary. One of us can carry, Prefect Bankal." Kober set his primary whiphound to sword mode and cut open the control panel casing. Inside was a gooey, glowing confusion of tangled connections and modules. "Attempt interface," he told the whiphound, holding it by the handle while its filament formed a questing tentacle, using the quick matter mechanisms on the second edge to override or hotwire the panel systems. "Panel confirms vacuum in shaft," Koba said, after a few seconds. "Elevator seems to be at the far end. I think we can open the door, but I can't rule out booby traps or a false pressure reading." "Tell your whiphound to open it in 20 seconds, Perek said. "Squad, fall back 30 meters and assume defensive posture." Koba issued the command, leaving his whiphound still interfaced with the panel, and scuttled back to join the others. The prefects crouched low against the wall, tucked their heads down and formed cross-shaped defences with their arms. Sparva hunkered down and closed his eyes, not caring to dwell on how little protection his M-suit would give against flying debris or a sudden pressure blast. He need not have worried. The door opened without incident, not even a breath of air escaping from the shaft. The squad advanced back to the holding area. Perek approached the dark void beyond the now open door,
steadying herself by one hand against the doorframe as she peered in and down.
"See anything?"
Sparva asked.
"Just a vertical shaft, Prefect Bankal."
Perek opened her fist.
"Here, boy."
Her whiphound sprung into her grip, snapping its filament into itself. "Drop to the limit of the shaft. If you survive the impact, hold station at maximum threat readiness. We will descend on suit thrusters."
Perek flung the whiphound into the void, giving it an initial burst of momentum to assist it on its way.
"Good luck," Sparva heard her whisper. The whiphound dropped, freely at first, and then skidding against the wall. The further it went, the more speed it picked up, the walls of the shaft racing by ever faster, a moving plug of darkness hovering just out of range of the whiphound's battery of sensors.
1 kilometer, Perek announced, "still in vacuum."
Then, after what seemed to Sparva to be only a few more seconds,
2 kilometers, no alteration in the shaft.
Then,
3, must be close to halfway down, still no sign of...
Shit! Sparva had seen it too. A sudden bottom to the shaft, rising up unexpectedly soon. The whiphound's feed had gone dark. He frowned to himself, wondering why the whiphound had failed to detect that abrupt end to the shaft, when it should have been scanning well ahead of itself, preparing to use its traction coil to slow down as it neared the bottom. He only had to think about it a fraction longer to realize that there could have been no fault with the whiphound, and what had appeared to be the bottom of the shaft was nothing of the sort. It was the elevator, coming back up.
"Back off," he said.
"I... yes," Perek said.
"Immediate fallback."
"You want me to try shutting the door?" Cobra asked.
"No time,"
Perek said. Cobra retrieved his whiphound. The prefects scuttled back to the same 30-meter position where they had waited before, then crouched down and assumed defensive postures. Sparva took shelter behind them, mind racing as he tried to calculate how much time they had. The shaft was still in vacuum, still silent, not even a hint of vibration to give a clue as to the elevator's approach, if indeed it was still racing towards them. It was almost an anticlimax when the elevator came. They saw it rising through the door, fast, but not too fast, obviously decelerating rapidly as it neared the upper end of the shaft. A blur of motion, like a ramming piston, a soft thud as the elevator's momentum was absorbed, and then silence and stillness. All they could see of the elevator was its own door, lined up with the open door in the shaft, but presently sealed.
"Hold,"
Perek warned, as Cobra made a move to break formation. "We still don't know what's behind that door." It was sensible advice, because when the elevator door did open, it was as if a bright, soundless bomb had gone off. The shaft shook, flakes of debris shaken loose, a cloud of shot frozen air blasting past the party with almost enough force to tear them off the wall. It had not been a bomb, though, but merely the sudden decompression of the elevator, which must have been filled with air all the time it had been on the way up. Some safety circuit should never have allowed that door to open into vacuum, but Sparva guessed that time, or the damage already done to the outer door, had confused the system.
"Better hope there wasn't anyone in that thing,"
Gurney said. Still no one moved. They were waiting for the cloud to disperse, to get a clear view of the open elevator. Sparva watched intently. As gaps began to open in the white confusion, so his eyes insisted that there was a form coming into focus, an upright shape, like a tall, waiting figure. He was hoping it was his imagination. The gases would thin out, and there would just be the empty elevator, summoned by some automatic protocol once it detected activity at this end of the shaft. But Perek said,
"Someone's there."
The grey shape gained form and solidity. It was standing in the elevator, seemingly unmoved by the explosion. Perek unclipped her second whiphound.
"Forward scout mode," she said, in little more than a whisper.
Still wreathed in the dispersing traces of air, the figure stepped out of the elevator, placing one very precise and careful footfall after the other, managing a slow and deliberate walk, despite the near weightlessness. The last few gasps of air pulled away from the form. Sparva stared at it, trying to make sense of the conflicting information reaching his eyes. The figure seemed more animal than human, and yet there was something very wrong with its basic proportions. It was taller than any of the prefects, yet there was nothing above the shoulders. The headless form lifted an arm. It was carrying something, a dark object with the purposeful lines of a weapon. Slowly it brought the arm to the level. Perek's whiphound flung itself at the arm and the weapon. It made a noose of its coil and slipped the noose around the arm, swiftly and accurately as a carnival trick. The coil tightened, and the arm and the weapon fell away, severed along a clean, smoking line. The figure toppled slowly forward, bouncing softly before coming to a halt. Singh and Gurney dispatched whiphounds to safeguard the fallen form until it could be inspected at close range. Perek used hand gestures to signal the party to advance. They crept nearer to the body, wary of sudden movements. The severed arm had been holding a rifle-shaped thing. Sparva knelt down and extracted it from the paw-like grip of the hand, prizing furry fingers open to release the weapon. He recognized it for what it was, a crossbow. Then he turned his attention to the headless body. Beneath its layering of brown fur was the suggestion of powerful mechanical musculature. Where the head had been, if indeed there had ever been a head, was a ragged collar and a busy mechanism of bearings and pipes cut clean at the level of the neck. Perek turned to him. "This might sound impertinent, Prefect Bankal, but do you have the faintest fucking idea what this thing is?" Sparva met her eyes. His expression was all the answer she really needed. "I think we'd better take the lift," he said. Dreyfus cleared panoply and notched up the acceleration. The cutter was on an expedited burn, eating into the fuel reserves that it would need to make its own way back home. This emergency crossing would get them to Lethe in just under 27 minutes, a trade-off that Dreyfus considered more than satisfactory. "Captain Pell has undocked and pulled back to just outside the exclusion volume," Omonier told him over the link. "There was an attack from the anti-collision systems, but we don't think it damaged the cruiser too badly."
"He still isn't answering."
"Nothing, despite repeated requests."
"We're agreed that this isn't like Pell?"
"Pell's been duped. My guess is that he's standing by to read Doc if he gets the call from Sparva."
"Do we think that Caleb's able to hijack our communications that way?"
Dreyfus picked his words carefully, not caring to utter a direct lie to Omonier if he could help it. "If the brother's responsible for Wildfire, then I wouldn't put this past him."
"Damn it all. Didn't we patch all the holes last time?"
"There are always more holes. If there weren't, we'd be out of a job."
"Sometimes I wouldn't mind being out of a job," Omonier said.
Dreyfus heard the quiet strain in her voice, and knew exactly how she felt. They were all on the limit, all on the point of breaking. "Maybe the brother will give us some answers," he offered forlornly, before signing off.
"There is no brother,"
Carlin said, strapped into the position to the right of Dreyfus, exactly where Grobno had been before Dreyfus handed him back to the Ultras.
"Starsoff's admitted he has a grudge against the family. Why would you believe a word he says?"
The cutter made a sharp course change, a lumbering, multi-hulled cargo hauler looming close to starboard, then swerving past in a blur of navigation lights. Traffic control had done their best to clear the lanes for this rapid crossing, but there were obviously some loose ends. Dreyfus tightened his restraint belt against his paunch, just in case. "Starsoff was treated badly by the Voids, but that doesn't mean we should dismiss his story."
"I was in that room, Dreyfus. I heard the conversation. It was going on in front of my nose. No one's been frozen that long. The moment Spider Fingers mentioned..."
Dreyfus regarded him. "What did you call Starsoff?"
"Read as much into that as you like."
"Do you remember something, Junius? The first time you and I met. Properly, I mean. In Stone Hollow."
Garland shrugged. "Clearly it left a mark on you."
"I think it left a mark on both of us. Let me jog your memory a bit, though. You were delivering a lecture, one of your public rallies. I was the man in the crowd, wearing a hood, trying to pass unnoticed.
You picked me out with uncanny accuracy, even though you had no reason to suspect that I was present.
Oh, yes.
I remember now. I think the meeting ended with you face down in the mud, floundering like a beached whale.
Good. Then you'll also remember the Americano woman.
The what?
Her statue. The pioneer. The settler. She had her fist digging into the ground, trying to scrape some life from this new world. Oh, very tragic.
It was a statue. I needed somewhere to stand, to address my gathering.
And you just happened to choose her of all people. There were other statues in that habitat, Junius. But I think she called to you. You felt an affinity with her, even if you couldn't articulate it.
Didn't you hear what Stasov said?
That whole mess happened 300 years ago. There's a connection, Dreyfus said. I'm sure of it now, and deep down so are you. But I don't blame you for not remembering. Stasov said you'd already had at least one round of induced amnesia before he ever started working for the family. I think that was to suppress the memory of whatever it was that linked you to the Americano tragedy. But you got another dose, after your mother died. Pushed everything back even further. It's still in there, though. And my money says that Caleb's treatment wasn't anywhere near as effective. It's closer to the surface with him.
I'll say one thing, Dreyfus.
You may not be making any sense, but at least you've stopped blaming me for wildfire.
The cutter took a nosedive through the middle of a ring-shaped habitat, violating several dozen traffic regulations in one swoop. Dreyfus studied his guest, ruminating on his own feelings towards Garlin and the bruised dignity he still remembered from the encounter in Hospice Idlewild.
You chose to make yourself a person of interest, Dreyfus said, and I had a job to do.
Chapter 20. The elevator door closed, sealing the five of them into a little moving cube of vacuum. The inertial tracker in Sparva's helmet recorded their progress, marking the kilometers as they descended.
I think I might know what that thing was,
Koba said, almost hesitantly, as if he were wary of making a fool of himself.
If you have an idea, share it, Peric snapped. I don't know why it didn't have a head. Maybe it did once, but the rest of it reminded me of something I saw in the history lessons. When they sent people here, those early colonists, the ones raised by robots, the psychologists weren't sure whether or not to make the robots look like robots or people or something else. I think they tried all the different approaches in all the colonies they tried to start, but none of them helped much.
Koba's right, Sparva said, memories of his own sharpening into focus. They knew the children needed mentors, guiding figures, to help them with the first phase of development, until the colony had passed through a generation or two and become self-sufficient and stable. That was the plan, anyway. Some of the robots were done up to look like people, and that didn't work too well. Close, but not quite right. And even a child can pick up on all the ways that it's wrong. The Ursas were another approach. Forget trying to pass them off as people, go the other way instead. Big, furry teddy bears. Mentors and friends. But they didn't work out any better than the humans in the end.
You think that was an Ursa? Peric asked.
After 300 years, maybe not an Ursa, exactly, but something that was meant to remind us of one, Sparva said. Peric turned her visor to face him.
What do you think we're dealing with here, Prefect Pankal?
Ghosts, Sparva said. Bad memories. Some seriously bad history.
That'd be my wild stab in the dark. They had already passed the 3-kilometer mark, and soon it was 4, then 5. They felt glued to the floor now, but that was only in comparison with the near weightlessness they had experienced before. After the 6th kilometer, the elevator began to slow down, preparing for a smooth arrival at the base of the shaft. Their weight peaked, then settled back down to close to a G. Peric still had one whiphound. She fiddled with the setting dials, a nervous but understandable act of triple-checking.
"Be ready," she said.
Sparva felt a barely perceptible halting of the elevator. He eyed the door warily,
deciding it was wiser not to place his trust in any of the functions or readouts of the lock mechanism. There could be anything beyond that door, from vacuum to 1,000 crushing atmospheres of acid. He wondered which of them would be better off in either scenario, the prefects in their tactical armor or him in his tissue-thin M-suit. At least it would be quick for Sparva, if his worst fears were justified.
"Air exchange," Singh said. "I'm reading a rising partial pressure."
"Confirmed," Perek said. "Sniffer says breathable, too, but don't take any chances." Sparva's faceplate readout picked up on the same injection of air into the elevator. As the pressure pushed towards one atmosphere, his M-suit sagged around his form like a deflated bag.
"Equalizing," Koba said.
Without fanfare, the elevator door opened, an external door opening a moment later. Sparva blinked against unexpected brightness, disconcerting after the dim lighting of Lethe's corridors and shafts. The elevator faced the base of a steep-sided pit, with dark walls to either side, and a rectangle of hazy, wavering brightness above. The pit extended a few meters away from the elevator, with a set of plain-looking stairs climbing to the level of the top of the walls. Perek was the first to step out. She gave an order to her whiphound and sent it slinking up the stairs, until it fed back a view of the terrain surrounding the pit. Sparva took a moment to process what he was seeing. Nothing at all had prepared him for the procession of shapes and textures and colors streaming across his faceplate as the whiphound panned its eye to take in the full panorama. He had been counting on some kind of artificial volume, it was true, but not even his wildest imaginings would have touched on the spectacle as it now presented itself. It was a jungle, a dense, luscious explosion of life and form, plants and trees throwing back a shimmering palette of two vivid greens, of leaves and ferns scissoring against the sky of impossible blazing blue, seemingly too deep and distant to ever be contained within the smallness of Lethe. There were flowers, too, shocking pinks and blood crimsons, fiery oranges and rich blues, a superabundance of colours jarring his eyes, each jewel-like swatch jangling against the blue-green as if it hovered on some distant plane of its own, unconnected to the great mass of the jungle. It was beautiful in an overripe, gaudy sense, but what struck Sparva most forcibly was a powerful impression of wrongness. There was something too vivid and oppressive about this jungle, and all that he knew of Lethe told him that it had no business being here. He didn't like it. Still, they had come to investigate. Perek walked slowly up the stairs, her whiphound circling the edge of the open pit, ready to defend the position. She reached the top, took a step onto the level ground, made a cautious observation of her surroundings, then gestured for the others to climb after her. Koba, Singh, and Gurney followed, with Sparva being the last one out of the pit, struggling up the tall steps, which had clearly not been optimized for a pig's stride. They were in a small clearing, bordered on all sides by the lurid green of the jungle. Curving above them was that too blue sky, a projection onto the artificial ceiling of this opening inside Lethe. If the ceiling was dome-shaped, then they seemed to have come out nearer the edge than the middle. Under their feet was a carpet of grass, so uniform in colour and height that it could have been manicured. There was even a door-like rectangle of grass and subsoil hinged back from the pit, ensuring the pit's presence would be much less obvious when sealed. "It's a biome, obviously," Perek said, as if someone needed to fill the silence that had followed their emergence from the elevator. "Energy-intensive, too, keeping all this biomass alive. Now we know why this rock was still using so much power. Is this anything you were expecting, Prefect Bankal?"
"No,"
he answered. "Not headless teddy bears, not jungles, but I'd like to take a look further in, if we can."
"Sword modes will take care of this vegetation pretty easily," Koba said. "Our whiphounds can clear a path ahead of us."
"No need," Singh said. "Looks like someone's already gone to the trouble." She was pointing to a notch in the clearing, where a clear, if narrow, trail led into the depths of the jungle,
more or less in the direction Sparva had intended to go.
If that was there when we arrived, I missed it on the sweep, Perek said.
I guess it wasn't that obvious, Gurney said, not sounding in the least bit convinced.
Sing, Perek said.
Order your primary to hold this area while we move into the overgrowth. If we need to get out of this place in a hurry, I don't want to waste time searching for that elevator entrance. She called back her own whiphound. Forward scout mode. 10 meter secure zone. Following the line of that trail. Clear overgrowth as you go. Proceed. Perek's whiphound nodded emphatically and headed out of the clearing. The trail was densely canopied, and the whiphound soon passed out of sight, its presence betrayed only by a rapid, machine-like threshing as it used its second edge to widen the trail. The whiphound's moving point of view appeared on their visors as it forged its way down a narrow corridor of darkening, thickening green. The party set off after it, moving in single file with Perek in the lead and Sparva at the rear. They still had 7 whiphounds to provide immediate cover, Cobra donating his secondary unit to Perek, all 4 operatives using their whiphounds in sword mode to scythe away any lingering obstructions. They kept a respectful distance between each other, keeping out of range of the swing of the whiphound's stiffened cutting filaments. Soon the canopy had closed over them almost completely, forming a dappled ceiling, and the trail's meandering path quickly snatched the clearing from view. As the cutter made its final approach to Lethe, Dreyfus reflected on what he knew of Aurora's capabilities and intentions. He could guess what had happened with Captain Pell and the prefects aboard the Democratic Circus, although it was not a theory that he had the slightest intention of voicing in public. Aurora must have intervened, overriding the cruiser's communication link with Panoply and substituting her own orders for those of Jane Umanier. Where the Supreme Prefect desired a cautious, deliberate approach, Aurora sought only the quickest route to provocation. In Caleb, she saw either a threat to herself, or at the very least, a human puzzle that intrigued her, something which demanded her immediate and thorough interest. She had given Pell the instruction to return to Lethe, and, through no fault of his own, Pell had assumed the change of intentions was valid. Sparva, too, would have had no cause to second-guess the supposed word of Lady Jane. Dreyfus already knew Aurora could push her presence into Panoply's secret layers, infiltrating virtual spaces and communications channels, and now he had given her the means to reach the closed archives of the search turbines. All this was dangerous enough, yet he was certain that manipulating information was not the limit of her capabilities. If she wished, Dreyfus felt sure, she could have turned this cutter around and sent it scuttling back to Panoply. She had not played her hand, though, and that led Dreyfus to conclude that whatever now happened would be satisfactory to Aurora. The initial act of provocation had been achieved. The truth regarding Caleb would now come to light one way or another. She was present, he believed, some part of her at least, watching and listening, even if she had other eyes and ears elsewhere. He almost felt he owed her an acknowledgement, but they knew each other well enough by now. She would know that he knew, and that was enough.
"Something amusing you, Dreyfus?"
Garlin asked, just thinking about an old acquaintance. "The trouble with you being puppeted by Caleb is that you can't really help who else you come to the attention of. Ever felt like a fly in a spider's web?"
"No. Have you?"
"Once or twice." Dreyfus tapped the console and brought up an enlargement of Lethe, now close enough for visual acquisition.
"There it is, Julius. Ring any bells? If Starsoft's right, you spent half your childhood inside that rock, convinced you were still living in Chasm City. I bet this isn't quite the way you imagined your glorious homecoming. Your mother died here, I think, before her shuttle broke up on re-entry to Yellowstone. She was already dead and gone. Are you starting to remember anything of how it happened?"
"You're crazy, Dreyfus."
"But not so crazy that I can't tell when a man's starting to question his deepest assumptions. You do remember Starsoft, whether you want to admit it or not.
and that means there's a chance the rest of it's true as well. Garland's jaw moved, as if he meant to offer some riposte, but nothing came. The console chimed with an incoming transmission from the Democratic Circus.
Dreyfus, how are you doing, Captain Pell? A little surprised to see you arrive unannounced, Prefect. Have you been in contact with Prefect Bancarland?